The Manitoba Association of Christian Homeschools would like to thank the Learning House for sponsoring this recording.
Good morning. So good to see you all again. There we go. Test, test, test. Can you hear me in the back? Okay, just want to make sure. Well, listen, welcome to Modern History That Everyone Ought to Know. You're quite brave. It's 9 o'clock in the morning and you are in for a fast-paced history class. Are you in the mood for history? I hope so. Some of you are repeats and that thrills me. If anyone will ever come to hear me a second time, I'm encouraged. So maybe you're as weird as I am and you just like history. I think something happens at about age 40 where we realize we need to know some of this stuff. But let me tell you why I feel this is a pertinent topic, modern history. There are some reasons why I bring this topic to you. I think most of us are in dire need of a crash course on modern history because if we're going to teach it at home, it helps to have a heads up. But this is what happened to so many of us. If you looked at the traditional world history textbook, it starts with ancient times. There's a whole lot on Egypt because it's just cool. And then you zip through Greece and Rome and you hit the Middle Ages. You might soar through the Renaissance. Then all of a sudden you hit World War I and II. And then after that, honestly, most of us wind up graduating. You cross the stage and you get a diploma because your teacher has run out of time to get anywhere past World War II. Maybe you got a little tidbit of the Cold War, or perhaps there's some little final chapter on like computers and space. And, you know, it's just not their view. And so, in all honesty, it means that you didn't probably sit through a class that covered the last 70 years or so of world history. We almost call that current events. And so you're not really sure why our headlines are what they are in some parts of the world because we have no idea some of those things that just happened. So the good news is not all history programs are the same. We didn't write the mystery of history where each book holds the entire history of the world, because that's what makes books so boring. You don't have the space to write the stories that make it interesting. So we have each volume dedicated to a single time period. So volume one is ancient, volume two is medieval, volume three is the Renaissance Reformation, and volume four, our last book, starts at 1708 and goes up to 2012, meaning that the last quarter of that book is the last 70 years of history. It's from the Cold War up. That's what I want to bring to you today, because that is what explains a few things. We could look at the formation of North Korea, the history of Iraq and Iran, and the collapse of the Soviet Union, the war in Afghanistan, all that good stuff. Some of you weren't even born then, and that's your excuse. But for the rest of us, we were in the wrong kind of books growing up. As for why it matters, I think it speaks for itself that there's something to learn in history, although I'm still winning over some folks who were bored to death with it when they were in high school. I was too. And I think, though, we could all agree on the old adage that would say, those that fail to learn from history are destined to repeat it. So if we can agree on that, then we can get through this crash course together. But I do want to pray for our time. I so value your time. I'm glad you made it and that the weather was a little bit better today. So let's just take this to the Lord. Father God, thank you so very much for your creation. Thank you that we're here. Thank you that we have families, Lord, that we have been blessed. Our children are a reward according to the scriptures. Thank you for them. But Lord, it's hard. You know it is hard for us day to day to get everything done, to cover all the subjects. We might feel a little overwhelmed at times by world history. Help us to hone in, pay attention, to leave feeling better equipped and inspired to see your hand in history. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, friends. Well, our first topic is, since I've already talked about it, we're just going to jump right on into the Cold War. So there was an advisor to President Harry Truman who said in 1947, and I quote, "Let us not be deceived. We are today in the midst of a Cold War." What did he mean? Well, this advisor meant that the United States and the Soviet Union, who once had been allies, were now in this cold-ish war, as in they're no longer fighting with weapons. They are fighting instead with policy, They're fighting through propaganda, through scare tactics, and espionage. And as the slide would indicate, there would be thousands of bombs tested in the United States during the Cold War, just in case we needed to change the status of the Cold War to a hot one. The Cold War lasted 46 years. It will overlap parts of my own lifetime. Now, most would say that the Cold War started in February 1945 in Yalta. Yalta is an important city to know because it's in Crimea on the edge of the Black Sea. It is quite coveted by Vladimir Putin today. And in attendance in Yalta were the big three superpowers, of that being the United Kingdom, the United States, and the Soviet Union. Now, just for the context of this meeting, context always helps, doesn't it? So picture with me that D-Day had occurred in 1944, the invasion of Normandy. Then the Allies would win the Battle of the Bulge. That's January of 1945. And then this meeting is 1 month later. This is February of 1945. So it's just after the Battle of the Bulge. And the big three met openly to decide what to do with the world in the anticipation of getting rid of Adolf Hitler. He wasn't dead yet. So the leaders at Yalta, you have Winston Churchill for the United Kingdom, Franklin Roosevelt for the United States, and Joseph Stalin for the USSR, who sat in yesterday's topic on the bad boys. So you learned a little about Joseph Stalin. So there he sits. Now, they all had one thing in common, which was to destroy the Third Reich, the Third Realm, according to Adolf Hitler. But Joseph Stalin had completely different ideas in mind. All right, he's a dictator. He wants to strip Nazi Germany of all its resources and make it communist. That's his idea. And Roosevelt and Churchill, they want to rebuild Germany as a free nation. But look at their faces just one more time, because it's important. Look at Stalin's face. I think it sort of says everything, because it's as if an imaginary line is drawn in the sand at Yalta between two differing ideologies that are still with us today. We're looking at opposing world views, are we not? We're looking at capitalism and free market versus socialism and communism. We're looking at individualism versus collectivism. We're looking at freedoms versus heavy regulation. And I dare say we might be looking at private and public schooling versus homeschooling and the freedom to do so. All right. So to bring some compromise to the situation, it was agreed in Yalta. There they are. The big three decide, hey, here's what we'll do. If we could get rid of Hitler, then we'll divide Germany into three occupation zones. We'll make an American one, a British one, a Soviet one, and the French would be added later. And they decided that the city of Berlin would be divided the same, east and west. So, of course, after Hitler will commit suicide, then the Western powers are going to merge themselves together, and they will form Western Germany. That's what's in green on your map. And the Soviets are going to hold on to East Germany. That'll be in orange. And it contained that divided city of Berlin. Well, as the years went by, I think you know what happens in Berlin. Such a curious thing will begin to develop. The Soviets will begin to encircle Berlin with barbed wire. So often we think of the Berlin Wall as being a straight wall, and it's not. It's a circle. It's an encirclement. And they're trying to stop East Germans from defecting to the West, because that's where they would rather be. And that little fencing that started as barbed wire will stretch 96 miles. And this was, of course, the Berlin Wall. And does that not stand as such a tangible symbol of what we'll call the Iron Curtain? I mean, it's just sitting there looking at us to try to understand that it will divide the world by ideologies. Well, like most world leaders, President Truman, he followed Roosevelt. Roosevelt died in office. He did not want to lead the United States into a third world war, but he felt like, well, he needed to do something about this communism popping up. So in 1947, President Truman committed to a foreign policy that'll be named for him. We're going to call it the Truman Doctrine. And it basically said, okay, the United States won't try to undo communism where it already exists, because it existed in a few places in our world. However, we agreed by policy that if we saw it spread, we're willing to go to war. We'll send our boys to the line. Oh, and that policy, my friends, will spur on a few wars, as in Korea and Vietnam. We'll get to that. But on such an intriguing level, the Cold War will fuel the dangerous act of espionage. Oh, the spying that went on. It's quite fascinating. And that fear ran so deep, we'll even call it the Red Scare, after the color of the Soviet flag. I think Americans got so jumpy. I do believe for a time that the Cincinnati Reds would be renamed the Cincinnati Red Legs, just to not be looking like communists. Anyway, well, each side prepares for the worst. They build a few more planes, a few more tanks, bomb shelters. You know, we have a lot of preppers where I live, but that's nothing new. They were doing that way back then. Now, we'll get to the end of the Cold War just a bit later. We got to keep moving. So let's look and turn to the Korean War. Unfortunately, this is often nicknamed a forgotten war, but at the cost of a million lives, it's far from forgotten. It's just that it fell between World War II and Vietnam. So the background of the story is, in 1910, Korea is forcibly annexed by Japan. I don't know who Japan thought they were, their little bitty island. I think Great Britain's a little bitty island that ruled half the world. But anyway, this little bitty island of Japan forcibly annexed Korea. But that oppression that the Koreans are feeling comes to a screaming halt at the end of World War II, when 35 years later, Japan is stopped, forced to surrender. That's in 1945, after the United States drops a couple of atom bombs on them. That will always be controversial. Now, remember the big three? They're going to meet again. This time, they're going to meet in Potsdam, Germany. And why can they meet in Germany? Because Hitler's gone. Now, there's some new fellas on the scene. This time, new representatives. They're going to have Attlee for Great Britain, Truman for the United States, and Stalin. By the way, you guys come on in. I don't mind you running late. I notoriously run late. However, I just want to say you might not see the slides very well if you're too far up front. So sink back there or move around if you need to. All right. Let's see, where am I? So these guys in the second meeting of the big three in Potsdam, they're going to gather, and one of many topics is what to do with Korea. How do we help them? Because picture, Korea is now sort of orphaned, right? Their overseer, the Japanese, who they'd been under for 35 years, are now gone. And so they decide at Potsdam, well, listen, we'll let the Soviets will sort of babysit and adopt North Korea, and then we're going to let the Allies and the Americans take South Korea until both North and South Korea can, like, get on their, stand on their own two feet. Kind of sounded good on paper. However, by 1948, the Soviets had completely reneged on the agreement. They don't allow for elections. They will opt to simply set up a communist regime in North Korea without elections. And the atheistic state will be named the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. By the way, when you see the expression peoples in the title of a nation, it usually means it's communist. The man who's put it in place is Kim Il-sung. I think you've heard of him. He's the grandfather of Kim Jong-un. And the South Koreans, well, they'll stay true to the concept of hosting elections. They do. They'll set up a constitutional republic named the Republic of Korea. Pan back a little, friends. What do you see? I hope you clearly see this is the Cold War all over again, because you have Soviets supporting North Korea. You have the Americans, some allies, supporting South Korea. That's under Truman. And the dividing line between the North and the South is a little thing called the 38th parallel. This is a line of latitude. It's actually just north of Seoul, South Korea. Now, this might be the end of my story. We'd go to the next, but oh no, it doesn't end there. It doesn't stay quiet on this peninsula, because the leader of North Korea decides to invade the South. He wants the entire island of Korea, and bullets began to fly on June 25th, 1950, under Kim Il-sung. By the way, he's the smiling one. If you see all the Kims lined up, I'll show him in a minute. He's the smiling one. Why is there any concern at all from the United States that the North Koreans invaded South Korea? It's because of the Truman Doctrine. We agreed that, okay, if we see communism in existence, we'll leave it alone. But if we see it spread, were willing to die to stop it. And so the Truman Doctrine is the reason that we will join in the cause for South Korea. That's simply what happened. And it will fall under the United Nations Coalition. One of the most famous events would probably have to be, maybe, there's lots, but General Douglas MacArthur, at one point, he will arrange for a very brilliant and unexpected amphibious landing. Amphibious just means like from the water, but it's fun to say. Go ahead. Amphibious. Just say it with me. Right. So this landing at Incheon, and with that landing that no one expected because it was really hard, but he pulled it off. So North Korea actually fell to South Korea on October 19th, 1950. It's like, oh, the war is over. Communism has been stopped. No, that's not exactly what happened either, because unbeknownst to General MacArthur, 300,000 Red Army Chinese are going to show up on the border to help. That's under Mao Zedong. They're going to give some assistance. Well, to end the war, MacArthur wants to drop a nuclear bomb on China. He's going to be fired for that idea. Which, by the way, if you ask my grandfather about that firing of MacArthur, he would still talk about it from his grave. He was a Navy man, and that was just appalling to Americans. They couldn't believe. But why is he fired for the idea of dropping a nuclear bomb on China? Because it would violate the Truman Doctrine that said, we won't try to stop it where it already exists. It was already in existence. So he gets fired. By the way, I wanted to make this a little bit more personal to you, and so I dug around, and I've got some Canadian stories for you. You may know these, you may not, but I've got some. So we have, for example, let's see, I'm behind on one. Here we go. A couple of battles. How about the Battle of Cap Young? So in this battle, this is April 22nd, 27th, in 1951, there were Aussie and Canadian forces battling the Chinese. Thank you for your service. The Aussies really don't fare very well, but the Canadians, you hold the course, you inflict great damage to the Chinese. The Canadians lost 10, the Aussies are going to lose 32, but the Chinese are going to lose about 2,000. So you helped push back the North Koreans. But second, there's another battle, the Battle of Hill 187. This is May 2nd, 3rd, 1953. It's one of the very last battles in the whole Korean War. And both sides of the war are hunkered down in trench-style warfare, which is just the worst when you're deep in these trenches and battling it out. Steep fighting was felt by both sides. The Canadian forces will sacrifice 26 dead, 27 wounded, 7 became prisoners of war. I don't know their fate. I'd love to know if you know. And several military medals and honors were poured out and crosses awarded for the bravery of Canadians trying to defend Hill 187. That's before an armistice was agreed upon. Now, as time went by, the North Koreans slowly gained back anything that they had lost to South Korea, and the whole thing dissolved into an armistice. And you want to know what line they just crept back to? It was the same old line where it all started. They were back at the 38th parallel, and they're still there today. They are still there today. If you were to visit the region, I don't know if anybody here has been there. My husband's been there, but there's a 2.5 mile wide buffer of land between the North and the South. It's famously called the DMZ, which stands for the Demilitarized Zone. The situation is tense because we get nervous about today's leader in North Korea. That is, of course, Kim Jong-un, who's the grandson. So here's all the Kims. And as a little secret to keeping them in order, because their names sound so much alike to us, they all start with Kim. But the rest of it, their middle and last names are actually in alphabetical order. So you have Kim Il-sung, who was first set up. Then you have Kim Jong-il, and then you have Kim Jong-un. All right. So keep that straight. Now, by the way, we have some memorials for the service that both our nations would contribute. So there's a war memorial in Brampton, Ontario. Has anyone been there? Is that a field trip waiting to happen? I don't know how far away that is. You know, the geography is just off unless it's familiar to you. Is that like next door? Is that like how many? Oh, 20 hours. you know, here, there. Well, we have a war memorial also. So ours is in Washington, D.C. I did get a chance to go there. And what's kind of awesome is that the statues there are 7 feet tall, which is pretty big next to me. And they say that the statues are always looking at you, no matter where you stand. I know that's kind of creepy, but interesting. Has anyone been there? Oh, yeah. I see more people have been there than maybe it's closer. I don't know. I don't want to do the math. Anyway, we need to move on. Let's go to another story. This is the story of Ayatollah Khomeini and Iran. This plays out in 1979. Now, if you were in one of my courses yesterday, you learned that the history of Iran stretches way back to Bible times because in our Bibles, it's Persia. Don't ever forget that because it's fascinating. The hearts of the Persian people, they say that the fastest growing church is in Iran today. That just gives me chills. But Persia, as it's known in the Bible, let's give a little of their history. It was Ismail the First in 1502 during the Renaissance. He's the first Shah or the king who would brand Persia a Shiite Muslim nation rather than Sunni. Now, if you're not too familiar with Islam, it's sorely divided between Shiites and Sunnis. And that one fact explains a lot because Iran would stand as the only Shiite nation in the world today, and it's surrounded by Sunni neighbors. So they really don't all get along, which is actually kind of good. But that leads me to the Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. He's often called the Ayatollah because Ayatollah is not a name, it's a position, it's a title. All right. Moving on, so he's the highest ranking Shiite leader. And by the way, Shiites and Sunnis just have different theology, different structure of their faith. So they are different and have gone to war against each other a lot. So while he is a Shiite leader, at the same time, Persia was under Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. He's the Shah, which means king, but he's the one who's going to change Persia into Iran. It's a little mysterious, but Iran means land of the Aryans. Apparently, this man had actually kind of idolized Hitler. Connect the dots. We know Iranians, generally speaking, don't care too much about the state of Israel. So they're the land of the Aryans, which is what Hitler was all about. I don't even know. There's more research to be done there of that connection. But this Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, so he is their supreme leader of sorts. He's the Shah, the king, in the 1960s and 70s. This also means, friends, we have a nation with two heads, as in there's a spiritual leader who's quite revered, and there's this political leader, and that is a problem. They don't get along because this particular Shah, he's rather worldly. He's not really very religious. You can even see in this photo of him and his wife, he's in Western attire. His wife is not wearing a head covering. They're not particularly religious. In fact, they're growing more and more secular. And as far as they're concerned, it's all right if Iran grows secular too. But the Ayatollah is a deeply spiritual man. He will be exiled for wanting to oust the king, the Shah. And as we see many times in history, exiles backfire. He'll be exiled for his desires to oust. So he goes and spends some time in France, but pulls out, and through something called the Iranian Revolution, 1979, the Shah himself will be ousted. The Ayatollah comes back. He walks off of a plane, takes control. The Shah flees for his life. He actually goes to the United States, and the Ayatollah will reign supreme. The people decide they want their spiritual leader over their political leader. And he immediately will turn Iran into a Shiite theocracy. It's the only one in the world. It remains that today. It's the Islamic Republic of Iran. Well, that would be the end of my story. But if you've listened to me all weekend, you know I always add something. There's more. Some of you might know exactly where I'm going with this. But there's a pretty juicy story hanging in here. As in, remember when I said that the Shah of Iran, their king, had fled to the United States? Well, that's going to be a problem with the Iranians who are now under their Ayatollah. They want him back. They would like to execute him. So much so that they're going to take 66 American hostages from an embassy in Tehran. This is November 4th, 1979. They storm that embassy and they take these people. Do you remember it here? Like we remember it? Some of you are nodding. I don't know where you were in life. I was a freshman in college at that time. I didn't understand. What is a Shah? What is an Ayatollah? There was so much I didn't understand. Sometimes ignorance is bliss, isn't it? But here's what's going on. Jimmy Carter, who was our president at that time, by the way, he passed away quite recently. God bless him. He was a very strong Christian man who I liked as a person, but he didn't make a very good president. So he wasn't particularly popular. Well, anyway, he was in an impossible situation, Jimmy Carter. He wouldn't go back on his decision to give the Shah refuge in the United States because the Shah was dying of cancer. He was actually receiving treatment here in the States. So he doesn't want to not help that man, but he also has hostages, right, that he needs to do something with. So he tries to create leverage. So one of the things he does is he decides to freeze Iranian money that's in our banks. We're calling those frozen assets. He freezes them, thinking that gave him a bargaining chip. What all it did is make them more angry. So now the Iranians want their money and they want the Shah because they want to execute him. All right. Well, let's see. The stalemate of those hostages went on and on. Nobody could have dreamed how long it was going to last. And so our newscasters would get on and say day 50 of the Iranian hostage and then day 100 and 150. And the ticker just kept ticking, similar to our situation today. The hostages that are being held in Gaza, far many more days than any of us dreamed. But that's another story. So even after the Shah of Iran will die, because he does pass away, the hostages are still being held in Tehran. For one, the Iranians want their money back. They're demanding their assets. And now they also want an apology for the fact that we had ever given him refuge. Meanwhile, Ronald Reagan becomes our next president, because I told you, Jimmy Carter wasn't particularly popular. And so, in order to slap Jimmy Carter in the face, you won't even believe what the Iranians are going to do. They will finally decide to release the hostages, but they wait until 20 seconds after President Reagan is sworn into office. 20 seconds. Now, the reason that the Iranians are interested in humiliating Jimmy Carter in this fashion is because Jimmy Carter had shown also some mercy toward Anwar Sadat of Egypt, who had made friends with Israel. So it's this convoluted mess. That's a whole nother story of Anwar Sadat. I wish we had time for it. It's quite fascinating. It's in volume 4, if you'd like the story. All right, we got to stay with Iran. So our hostages are released. After Americans, we tied yellow ribbons around trees, all kinds of things. Then the Ayatollah will proceed to appoint himself the supreme leader of Iran for life. He will have presidents serve under him, no more kings. In fact, he'll oversee three different Iranian presidents. He will serve for 10 years. He was replaced by Ali Khamenei, who is still there. He is the supreme spiritual leader. And he became that in 1989. He holds that position. I would not say he has the clout that the former Ayatollah had, but he's still revered. But Iran has now a new president because, not sure if you caught the headline, but the former president, his name was Ibrahim Raisi, he died in a helicopter crash not terribly long ago. It was May 19th, 2024. As far as I know, it was a natural occurrence. I don't think that we have ever had any indication of foul play. But anyway, he died in a helicopter crash. And so he was replaced by Masoud Pezeshkian. Don't quote me. And he is in office now. So the world watches. We're not really sure when Iran is making policy, who is the world dealing with? Are we dealing with their spiritual leader or their political leader? Because they still have two. Okay, friends. Time to move along. We're going to turn to, strangely, one of my favorite topics. It's the collapse of the Soviet Union. Oh, boy. I don't know why. I do know why. I like the story because we're looking at the crash of communism. You might have figured out I'm not a big fan. All right. So the story is following the Bolshevik Revolution, covered that yesterday, in 1917. Quick review here. So Vladimir Lenin had established the USSR. 1922, he establishes it as an atheistic communist nation because the communists will not believe that religion or faith can play a part in their system. So that's why communism has generally been so anti-family and anti-faith. After Lenin, it sees the heavy hand of Joseph Stalin. He will lead the Soviet Union all the way through the Cold War into even the war in Korea. And when it came time to recarving what had been Nazi territory, you know, I told you what Stalin wished he could do was to make Germany all communist. Well, he can't quite accomplish that because Germany will be divided. However, he will inherit these satellite states. He gets satellite states. Let's go over them real quick. This will include Albania, Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia. Here's what helps. That's ABC. So at least you can get started on the right three. Then let's add East Germany, Hungary, Poland, and Romania. Oh, my dear friends, the history of the satellite states is uniquely morbid. They will go through some of the worst oppression, particularly believers. Are any of you familiar with Richard Wurmbrand? I saw somebody walking around yesterday with a bag that said Voice of the Martyrs on it. So perhaps they're here, but he was the founder of Voice of the Martyrs. He was a Romanian who came to Christ and spent a lot of time in prison. He wrote Tortured for Christ. If you ever want a good cry, read Tortured for Christ. Anyway, so yes, a lot will suffer in these satellite states. In fact, we do believe that the death toll under Stalin will be 34 to 49 million from failed policies that I covered yesterday, this collective farming and famine and all kinds of things, their gulag system. Now, just for the record, that's 2.5 times as many as Hitler, although he gets the record for being maybe the most notorious for how he disposed of people. But Stalin doesn't have quite the track record of Mao Zedong, who is probably responsible for the most. But let's stay with the Soviets here. So the Soviet Union fell to a few other communists before it fell to Mikhail Gorbachev. Nicknamed Gorby, because we kind of like him, just so you know. He also passed away not terribly long ago. I thought the world would make a bigger to-do of it, but it really didn't. So he became the general secretary in 1985, and he's different. He has a couple of different policies. He's not quite like his hard-nosed predecessors. One of his policies is glasnost, which means openness. Then he has a policy called perestroika, which means restructuring. And it's those policies that put the rest of this story into motion. Because the satellite states are looking around. They're not a happy people. They're oppressed by the Soviets. Not fully Soviet, but they've got these overlords. And so they think to themselves, could we be a more open society? Could we restructure? Let's try it. They're brave. The most well-known example in 1989, the Berlin Wall, will be torn down brick by the people. I would love to have been a spectator there. I watched it by television. Thousands of East Germans show up and they start to tear down the Berlin Wall because remember, this is a satellite state at the time and it was just an odd moment in history because they're not being shot at. They're not being put on trial. They're not arrested. The people just stormed it. They really did just storm it. It was quite something. They declared their independence from the Soviet Union and earned it. And as a result, the rest of the republics in the Soviet Union, because there was 22 republics, 7 satellite states, the republics looked right and left. They're like, look what these guys are doing. I wonder if we could do it. And they did. So within 2 years, 15 Soviet republics declared their independence from the Soviet Union. They're like, enough of this. It's not working out so well. Now, I'd like you to note on your screen where I listed these republics, by the way, that Russia and Ukraine are two different republics of the former Soviet Union. They are not one and the same, as Vladimir Putin would like us to believe. But we're going to get to that story. Russia, by far, is the largest republic of them all. Now, listen up. So in 1991, sorry, I just sound like a school teacher. Listen up. Okay. In 1991, the Russian people, since they had declared their independence, they vote for a president. They had seceded from the Soviet Union, and they vote for Boris Yeltsin. You heard of him? He's this tall, white-haired, kind of hard-to-forget man. He is really flamboyant, and the people have high hopes in Boris Yeltsin. We just voted for a president. Yay. And I'm happy for them. But the election of him being a president now has created an enormous imbalance because the Soviet Union is not dissolved yet. Mikhail Gorbachev is still in charge of all of it. And so you've got this, you got odds here. For a brief time, these two men, Yeltsin and Gorbachev, they actually are both in charge of Russia, the largest land mass of the Soviet Union, and they literally share space at the Kremlin. They're not friends. They do not like and care for each other. And you can even see it in their faces here. This picture is, I think, kind of priceless. Now, I don't have time for all the dramatic details, but there'll be a coup. There'll be a dramatic coup of some hardline communists trying to raise Mikhail Gorbachev back up. They throw him on an island for a while. They bring him back. It's really just quite the story. But it doesn't work. And believe it or not, Gorbachev will choose to step down. He resigned. You realize this is very unusual behavior for a communist leader. And the day he resigned was December 25th, which we recognize as Christmas Day. Now, I realize that the truth is Jesus probably wasn't really born on December 25th. That's the day on the calendar that we recognize his birth. But the world would recognize December 25th as the biggest, like, Christmas, Christian holiday. And to think that this atheistic communist regime would begin to go down on that day just makes me think that the Lord is watching and saying, watch me, watch me. It'll be Christmas Day where we're going to see Gorbachev resign just to let us know he's watching. He saw, he knew of the suffering in the satellite states. He still reigns. Now, the official day of dissolving was December 26th. One day later, he resigned, and you could say the Soviet Union officially dissolved. It's dead. Friends, I study a lot of world history. The collapse of the Soviet Union, I haven't gotten over it yet. It is one of the most unprecedented falls ever because it was so short-lived, and it's so unexpected by the brutality, by their policies, by all that they were known for. The Soviet Union, it collapsed at age 69. It's as if it had a heart attack and died early. And the sad thing is, Yeltsin, as much hope as the Russian people had in him, he didn't do a very good job because their economy was a mess because communism doesn't work. He didn't lift them up fast enough out of their ills. And so he resigned in 1999, a very unpopular man. They don't give him much credit. So you want to guess who Yeltsin would choose to replace him? Go ahead. Just guess. You're right. You're thinking it. Who? Just say it. Somebody. You're killing me. Yes. He put Vladimir Putin in place to replace him. Friends, it's no wonder he's in our headlines today. Putin would happen to be on his fourth term of presidency, though that's not what their constitution calls for. One term, he's just a prime minister. So we're looking at over 20 years of Putin power, and it's gone to his head, I think. We're going to circle back to him, but I just wanted you to know that. All right, friends. Let's see. I have two more stories. Are you good? You need coffee? Can't help you. Maybe she will. She brings me coffee, this wonderful lady on the front row. All right. Let's go to the war on terror. Modern headlines. On the same day that terrorists would slam planes into the Twin Towers in New York, this was September 11th, 2001, President George W. Bush, he declared a war on terror because it was assumed pretty quick that that was Osama bin Laden who was responsible for that. And the U.S. quickly mobilized a whole coalition to retaliate. And it starts in Afghanistan because bin Laden had set up camp there. Literally, Al-Qaeda means camp. He set up a camp. Now, he's from Saudi Arabia. He's actually a very wealthy man, but he's disowned by his own family and the Saudi Arabians. So he goes out as a nomad, sets up a base in Afghanistan, who welcomed him. So just 26 days after 9/11, the war in Afghanistan started that we were both involved in. Some of your family may have served. I don't know. Raise your hand if you had family or you yourself served in the war in Afghanistan. But we know that it was the longest combat deployment in your history. So you had a major role at Kandahar. There's Operation Apollo, Athena, Archer. You like the A's? A? Just thought of that. Sorry. y'all really do say that. It's really funny. And I really do say y'all. So we're even. But anyway, you lost 159 in combat. You lost 22 in non-combat. So I know you know this story. So the thing is, this war drags on in Afghanistan. 2 years later, the war shifted significantly, as in our president, President Bush, redirected the war from Afghanistan to Iraq because of a man named Saddam Hussein. The war had shifted. Now, it was unclear at the time if Saddam Hussein had anything to do with the 9/11 attacks. Probably didn't. However, it's assumed that he had stockpiled weapons and that he had these weapons of mass destruction. That's the line. And it's unclear, but nonetheless, the administration of the United States shifts gears and is like, well, we're not finding Osama in Afghanistan anywhere. Let's, while we're at it, let's just head on over to Iraq and take care of this guy. So we have something called the Second Persian Gulf War. This is fought from 2003 to 2011. There's a quick side note. There's a First Persian Gulf War. That's called Operation Desert Storm. And in that one, it was fought in 1991. That had to do with those oil fields in Kuwait. Some of you will remember that lasted only 43 days, but it's real easy to confuse them. So in the second Gulf War, it starts favorably for the Allies. Within weeks, Hussein's palace is occupied by coalition forces. And on April 9th, 2003, some U.S. Marines actually put some chains around a statue of Saddam Hussein, yank it to the ground. This is in Baghdad. It's a real statement. It's very symbolic. Even more memorable, 8 months later, on December 13th, 2003, they find Saddam Hussein. He is literally hiding in what we'll call a spider hole. This is a one-man bunker built into the earth. It's about 6 to 8 feet deep. Now, I have to tell you something really eerie that I never heard the news say, but Saddam Hussein liked to pretend that he was a lot like Nebuchadnezzar. When he would host big palace feasts and festivals, which he did, he put up banners all the time of Nebuchadnezzar and Saladin. Nebuchadnezzar he idolized because he had once subdued the Jews. Saladin had been involved in the Crusades, so he wanted also the reputation of having subdued Jews. So he would liken himself to Nebuchadnezzar. Well, interestingly, if you follow the life of Nebuchadnezzar, toward the end of his years, the Bible would say in Daniel that Nebuchadnezzar was driven from men, ate grass like oxen. His body was wet with the dew of heaven till his hair had grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws. I'm sorry, but when they pulled this man out of the ground, I'm like, he does seem a little bit like Nebuchadnezzar. With that captured Saddam Hussein and his wild, disheveled hair and unkempt and all that. Now, the end of their lives is not quite the same. We do have biblical record that Nebuchadnezzar would actually turn to the Lord, but Saddam Hussein, we don't have record of that, and I don't think so. Hussein will be charged and executed by his own people for crimes against humanity because he had killed and oppressed 1 to 2 million Kurds in the 1980s. The Kurds are not really an Iranian people. They're a people that used to have a land, and now they're in the middle of other people's land and it's a mess. The death of Saddam Hussein did not end the war in Iraq, because then we had numerous groups jockeying for power, because that's what happens when you take out a dictator. Be careful when you remove one. So, but what happens of Afghanistan? Will that war continue to rage on as well for 8 more years, when seemingly out of nowhere, do you remember the day? Finally, the news will say that they had captured and killed Osama bin Laden. He was found in Pakistan, May 1st, 2011, 10 years after 9/11. I'm suspicious of the 10-year mark. I'm like, really? 10 years? There could be corruption behind that. We don't know. But the world exploded with reaction, both good and bad, depending on what side you were on. Bin Laden's body was buried at sea. 7 months later, President Barack Obama would finally end the war in Iraq, December 18th, 2011. But the death of Osama bin Laden did not end the war in Afghanistan. They kept it going. It went on and on where it had started, at the cost of thousands of lives of your guys and mine. And as so many of you are painfully aware, it only ended kind of recently. There was a debacle of an evacuation. You know, that was in August of 2021 when late American forces finally pulled out in this botched up evacuation. It seems like that was far more recent than that, but that was 2021. All right, friends, Miss Linda needs to talk fast, as if I don't. All right, I have one more story to tell. and this is painful, a little bit more recent, but I just feel it's so significant to look at the invasion of Ukraine. Not that it's the only present war we have, but it's the one I'm going to talk about now. Our hearts hurt for the people caught in present-day conflicts. There's innocent peoples, probably on both sides, dying, innocent Russian boys, innocent Ukrainians, being forced to lines to shoot and kill each other. They're in the crosshairs under Putin's policies. Now, as a quick disclaimer, I don't believe historians are ready yet to really give this whole story because it's still ongoing. There are probably levels of corruption in this story that we may never know. So I can't really give you today's present figures on that. We realize they are negotiating as we speak between peace and no peace between Russia and Ukraine. But what I can do as a historian is give you some historical backdrop to some shared history between Ukraine and Russia, because believe me, it's being used for the good and the bad. So that's what I'm going to do. That's my job. So we're going back as early as the 7th century. We're talking before Christ. Eurasian nomads, the Scythians, they moved into that area. They went to present day Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine. And then the Greeks figured out that was a smart place to trade. So they joined in and around the Black Sea. That is the most coveted region for trade. That's what Putin's after. This is a hot spot of trade. It's booming by the 2nd century BC, and so it attracts more. We have Sarmatians, Goths, Huns, like Attila the Hun. We have Bulgars, Slavs, Khazars, Magyars, Mongols. Fun to say some of those names from where we're going to get Bulgarians, Slovakians, Kazakhstan, others. Anyway, these people are so diverse that they actually figure out they need to set up three different, courts based on religion, as in there'll be two Jewish courts, two Christian courts, two Muslim courts. Oh, and there's like one court for the pagans. Okay, so this is a diverse group of people, but they're getting along. Somehow they're a melting pot, but they all have one single threat. And their threat will be the Vikings, for crying out loud. The Vikings, by the 10th century, the Vikings looted and settled land all the way from Novgorod to Kiev. That's the orange and the green that circled on your map. Now, they're going to call themselves the Rus, which is probably where we get the name of Russia, though there's a few other theories. Now, stay with me here because Rurik will be a Varangian Viking. He's the first leader of the Rus, and he founds the Rurik dynasty. I mean, they're even dressed like Vikings, just the way you'd picture them here. He has a successor. His name is Oleg of Novgorod. He will be considered the Grand Prince of Kiev. That Kiev, by the way, is the capital of Ukraine. So he starts the kingdom that follows. And the interesting thing is that in the last decade or so, historians have given a label to this thing, and they call it Kievan Rus. It's been set apart in history with a name. And why is it set apart? Well, because it was a medieval kingdom. It lasted 358 years, which is actually a pretty long time, but it's not on the map today. So they decided, let's give it a name. It's Kievan Rus. That name was given to this area before the conflict we now have between Russia and Ukraine. At its height, Kievan Rus covered parts of modern day Russia, a small strip of Poland, all of Belarus, and most of Ukraine. As a matter of fact, there'll be a man in history named Vladimir the First, not Putin, Vladimir the First. He's born in 956. He's the 5th Grand Duke of Kiev, and he's the one that determined what religion his state would follow back in the days where state and church were quite related. And so the story is that Vladimir, he was unclear if he wanted his people to follow the Western Roman Church or the Eastern Roman Church, which would become the Orthodox. And so he sends out some reps. He's like, go visit the churches. Let me know what you find. And allegedly the visitors go and they come back saying that they thought the Eastern Orthodox was just more beautiful. I'm not really sure which churches they went to because I think the Western ones are pretty too. But they went and said, that's the one we like. And so he says, okay, which is why today there are those domed onion looking cathedrals that are Orthodox all over Ukraine. It was Vladimir who chose that. By the way, when the war first broke out between Russia and Ukraine, I know newscasters would stand in bulletproof vests, usually in front of a cathedral, So often they were standing right in front of St. Sophia Cathedral. And interesting, it was on Putin's list of historical sites to destroy. I don't think he ever got there. I do believe he was stopped because he didn't quite get Kyiv like he hoped. But the point of the Russians is that they were looking to destroy historic sites, destroy history that was unique to the Ukrainians. So I believe it's still standing. But anyway, moving along, friends. Does the medieval history of Kievan Rus matter? Well, I think it certainly does to Putin, who has really distorted it for his barbaric purposes. I think it certainly matters to Ukrainians who are fighting for their very lives. And I just still pray that the Lord will have mercy on the innocents who are caught in this, as we would pray for anyone caught in wartime, be it just or unjust wars. We hate to see the loss of life because you and I are made in the very image of God. That is where our value comes from. So it matters. Well, speaking of mercy, since I've drug you through all this modern history, and it's a bit heavy. I mean, I have to admit, as a believer, I have to straddle faith and fear sometimes. Sometimes it's fearful to look at our head times, but I have too much faith to stay in fear, but I've also studied too much history to not have a little concern, right? So we do. But here's the end of the story. I know you know I'm amongst believers, but Revelation tells us one day there's going to be a new heaven and a new earth. I don't understand that because the Bible also says there'll be no sea. And I'm like, but how could we not have water? So I don't know how that's going to look. But we are told in one of the most beautiful verses, I think, in the entire Bible, that the leaves of the tree of life will be for the healing of the nations. Sometimes that makes me cry, that there would be healing of the nations. The Bible says there'll be no more curse and fallenness. Those words are so powerful. Now, I don't know if it's common amongst you to say amen, but where I'm from in the South, we yell amen to something. So say it, amen. Hey, get an amen. Yeah. So that's good news. That's the good news of the gospel. Not only are we saved, but there'll be healing of the nations in God's sovereignty and somehow in his economy. Meanwhile, you're left to teach your kids. Good luck with that. I'm retired. It was so worth it. I'm glad I did. But what I want to end on is just a quiz. Let's see how well you learn, because I want you to feel more equipped to teach your kids. And by the way, it's not as if you're going to sit by your kids and remember everything, not all the biology and algebra and world history that I just gave you. You will be learning alongside them probably, and that's okay. But let's just see for fun. If you remember a thing, you ready? Number one, many would say the Cold War started at the meeting of the Big Three in which city was the first one where Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin gathered to reshape Nazi territory? Where was the first meeting of the Big Three? Pardon me? Yalta. Yes, Yalta. Right. A coveted spot along the Crimea. All right. What four-star U.S. general wanted to drop a nuclear bomb on China during the Korean War, and he's fired for it? Who was that? That was Douglas MacArthur. Sure was. Number three, in the Iranian hostage crisis, over 60 Americans were held in Tehran. I don't think I actually said the number out loud a while ago, so forgive me. I know the number. Does anybody want to guess how long they were held? What say? 444. Yeah, 444. Number four, in 1991, the Russian people seceded from the USSR and elected a tall, white-haired man to be their president. Who did they elect? Boris Yeltsin. That is correct. And number five, Osama bin Laden, the founder of Al-Qaeda and orchestrator of 9/11, was buried at sea in what year? When? That's right, 2011, 10 years after the slamming of the towers. And number six, historians have recently labeled the medieval kingdom of Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine. And I gave you some funny. Is it Varangia, Ruskrania, Sophieland, or Kievan Rus? Kievan Rus, yes. All right, friends, it's time to wrap up. And I wanted to assure you that I have materials. If you like how my lectures have gone, I write like I lecture. And I wanted you to be aware of our volumes. How am I on time? I think I have 2 minutes. And so I want to use this for question and answer, particularly about the curriculum if you have. So there's four volumes for all ages. that works because there's stories and then there's curriculum. It's a two-part resource. The curriculum has stuff for younger, middle, older. So any questions on the mystery of history or comments on the lecture? No, you're stunned. I know. Hey, I'm the one that just put out 5,000 words. You can come up with a few. All right. Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said. You're using the Mystery of History. Okay. Oh, thank you. She said she liked the Mystery of History. It's working for her group. Thank you. I'll put that into the microphone. Well, if you're interested in starting a group, some form of tutorial or co-op, I did a podcast on how to use the Mystery of History in a co-op or classroom. It's been really popular. I think it's the highest hit podcast I've ever had, because at least where I live, these models of education have popped up where a couple of days a week the kids meet with some teachers and 3 days a week they're home. And anyway, we fit that model well if that's a need for you, because you can read the stories at home as families, which retains that parental authority. I like that the parents would be involved in the stories and learning with their kids, but then the teachers get to do all the glitter and glue, the things you don't want to do, you're happy to pay for. You make a map. You do a paper mache thing with the kids. All right. Any other questions about the curriculum? Comments on world history? Have you had a favorite world history lecture so far this weekend? The Bad Boys of the 20th Century. I've been given that one for a while. Oh, yes. Oh, when Bible history and world history meet face to face. Yeah. That's an important one. It kind of sets the tone for the whole series, which is that I integrated Bible and world history. And you know what's interesting about that to me personally is that that came out of a deficit in my life, because I didn't know the Bible as a kid. I couldn't have told you the difference between Noah and Moses. So I knew I didn't want my kids to inherit that. So sometimes God works in mysterious ways. He takes something not so good in our life and can turn it around. At least he did for me. Now, just so you know, and I think I've mentioned in other sessions, but I do have lectures that I offer to go along with our volumes 3 and 4. Now, the lectures or self-paced classes, they don't replace the reading of the book, because you get the stories first. I give you like the main stuff first in the books, but I added to it for students that might be looking for more, perhaps their middle school or high school. And the self-paced class is a structured format where they get kind of a day-to-day lesson plan, and I tell them exactly what to do. Then they also get these like 20-minute lectures I give with slides. I'm telling them more. And that's good for independent students. But maybe you have a family that you don't really need that structure, but you just want to get hold of the lectures because you have a very visual learner. You can buy the lectures separate as a standalone. We made sure to do that. And that's the podcast if you'd like to seek me out. Well, thank you so very much. I'm going to be lecturing in the next big room on the biblical blueprint for home education. That's a bit for a larger crowd. There's going to be a little history in there, because that's just what's going to happen if you have me speak. But it won't all be on history. We'll do some good old-fashioned homeschooling tips and such. Thank you so very much.
Once again, the Manitoba Association of Christian Homeschools would like to thank the Learning House for sponsoring this recording. Please visit them at learninghouse.ca.